NTU World of Wisdom. Welcome to High Impact Thesis. In this podcast, we speak with researchers from various scientific fields to talk about the motivation, goal, and potential impact of their research. We also want to give you a sense of how a PhD is carried out with an emphasis on the PH, the philosophical aspects involved in pursuing a PhD.
Welcome everyone to another episode of the High Impact Thesis. This is me, Ahmed Hussein, and hosting together with me is...
Mohammed.
And our guest for this episode is Dr. Gopi. Dr. Gopi, welcome to the podcast.
First of all, thank you very much for the warm welcome. It's finally happy to be doing this in a physical meeting. So I'm Dr. Gopi. I did my PhD from Interdisciplinary Graduate School. And I had two supervisors guiding me throughout my PhD journey. One being main supervisor from School of Civil and Environmental Engineering, the school that I majored in. I got to work with Prof. Woon Jan Ng, who was the founder and executive director of NURI, Nanyang Environment and Water Research Institute. And I would say I was the fortunate one because I was fortunate enough to be his student. And luckily, I was also the last student. And he retired right after I graduated. So I have another supervisor from School of Chemical and Biomedical Engineering, which is now CCBE. Prof. William Shen, and they both jointly guided me and gave insights on the type of research that I need to do in order to convince audience from two different backgrounds, obviously from CEE and CBE.
And this is typical in the school you're affiliated with, which is the Interdisciplinary Graduate School.
Yes, which is now Interdisciplinary IGP. Yeah, back usually all the students at IGP are given two supervisor. One will be the main supervisor, the school in which you majored from, like in my case, from CEE. And I have to choose another school or rather another topic that is like a common point for my project. So I'll be using techniques from both the backgrounds to do my research. So in this case, I have chosen Prof. William Shen to be my co-supervisor, and I have used microbiological techniques from his background, and he guided me throughout in that part of my research. While for the treatment of wastewater that I'm working with, my main supervisor has guided me. How those two schools came together.
So what is your research like? If you can give us an overview of your field.
I worked with microbial treatment of textile wastewater for my PhD. So textile wastewater is a global problem. Tons and tons of wastewater being produced every single day. And when they are released into the environment without treatment, they pose threat to various segments, land, plants, aquatics, and even human beings if they come in contact with. So this problem needs to be addressed. And while I was going through the literature to find out the best possible solution to treat the textile wastewater, I found that microbiological techniques are the most sustainable and economical way to do so. So that's what my PhD is overall.
Within the generality, what is the source of textile wastewater? Like, what does that mean? Because I have no idea what that means.
Okay, so there are textile industries. There is at least 10,000 types of synthetic dyes available today in the market. 70% of them are quite complex in their structure, like in terms of their chemistry. Less than 50% of them are degradable. So they are persistent. They can't be degraded so easily.
That is desired, right?
Yeah, that is desired because for the color fastness, like if you wear your clothes and if the color goes off after first wash, you don't want to wear them anymore, right? Mm. So that's the reason why the dyes are designed in such a way that they are very chemically stable so that your clothes remain the same even after a few washes, right? So that's the reason why these dyes are artificial dyes are designed in such way. And if you see at the textile industry, there is dye baths. It's like a huge tank with colored water, and the textile is dumped inside and kept there for some time. And in some cases, you have to boil the colored water to give them so that the the color is more attached to the cloth, or sometimes you have to add in salts like sodium chloride, the common salt that we all eat every day, or sodium sulfate, so that the different intensities of the colors are achieved. So once the dyeing is done, the rest the cloth is retrieved, and the rest of the water, there is, of course, none of the processes are 100% efficient. So there is still some color left in this dye bath. So that is called spent dye bath. So now this one is not reusable because there is some color. Maybe in the next batch you want to put another color to the clothes, right? So this one needs to be disposed, or you must remove the color and you can reuse within the same industry for the next batch, right? So, yeah. So there are some industries that dispose of this waste, colored waste water, and which affects the environment. So that's why it is important to treat this waste water. That's how waste is generated. Yeah.
They just let it out into like the nearby.
Into the nearby streams, and they're not, like I mentioned, they're not readily degradable. That's why they need to be treated before they are let into the environment, and that's where agencies like National Environment Agency, Singapore Environmental Protection Act, see by the US, EPA, EPA by the US. These agencies have their own regulations on industries that generate this kind of wastewater, toxic wastewater. So they have to make sure that those particular parameters are achieved before they can release the wastewater into the streams.
And so where do you come in this, like, why is there a need for research? Because you just mentioned like those agencies exist to regulate the waste. So what is the current like state of this issue?
Okay, so first of all, the number one problem is that nobody knows how much of colored wastewater is generated on a daily basis. Of course, there have been reports that stated that a number that ranges anywhere between 10 to 700,000 tons of textile wastewater being released around the globe per year. But nobody is so sure about it. Like, if you see 10,000 tons and 700,000 tons, it's such a extreme number to give. So nobody knows how much is the actual quantity that is being released, and with this kind of climate change and water scarcity that we are going through right now, there is of course a necessity to treat this kind of toxic waste waters. And that's where, as a civil and environmental engineer, my role comes in. And like I mentioned, after a thorough literature review, I've understood that doing this, like removing these colors from the wastewater using microbes, would be the best possible way, because it's sustainable, cheap, and also effective at the same time. So that's where me as a civil and play as a researcher.
So this technique of using microbes, has it been already started before, or is it in just research circles, or has it been actually?
Oh, no. Like, if you see, there is Jurong Water Reclamation for this. So there is Jurong plant. So they, you see, there are huge tank process going on. So they take 80% spill waste water that is generated from the household, like water coming kitchen, garden, those things. They all go to water plant and have some industrial streams. So they have been already doing some things. This, my biological treatment techniques have been in so long. But like I mentioned, this Juran JRP, it's designed to treat particular kind of, which is domestic, which we produce on a daily basis. But for what is like, none for the type of industrial, different types of producing, there is no one size fits all. You have to have a solution for this.
So microbes work really well for brown water, and we know that already, and it's being used.
Yes.
And you guys are bringing microbes over to industrial waste now.
Something like that. But it's, I wouldn't say that I am the first one to do this. The research on microbes for treatment of textile waste water has been for at least two to three decades now. But initially though the results were quite good, but because the process is quite slow, because it's dependent on live organisms, and of course the dyes are toxic by themselves, and in most cases the textile wastewater also contains salts, like I mentioned earlier, right? The dye baths are sometimes topped up with salts, and the salt content is not less. It's about 40 to 200 grams of salt per 1 liter of textile wastewater. And if you want me to give a comparison, the Great Salt Lake has about 50 to 270 grams of salt per liter. So it's almost comparable. So at this kind of salt concentration, usually microbes doesn't flourish. So there have been studies where researchers have tried to use the conventional wastewater treatment plants for textile wastewater, and then they have failed. Sometimes the dye would just get trapped in the sludge, or sometimes the dye would just come out without being treated. The same color goes in and it comes out as such. So they have already faced some issues like that before. And sometimes even the microbes can die. They can't flourish in that kind of extreme saline conditions. And of course, dyes are toxic by themselves, and they're complex in their chemistry. So...
Doesn't this seem like a Dead Sea kind of situation where there's too much salt for anything to live?
Uh-huh.
So how do you find a microbe that can actually flourish and actually do something that you want in that kind of situation?
Yeah. Like I mentioned, even the Great Salt Lake has some microbes that are flourishing.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So there exists some microbes that can do the job that I want. So, yeah, I try to go around different wastewater reclamation plants. I didn't particularly go look at the microbes. I didn't collect microbes from the sea or ocean per se, because salt is one of the parameters that I'm looking at for my studies. So what I did was, instead I went to the water reclamation plants, collected some sludge from there, and got it to the lab. I gave it shock loading, in the sense I gave 10,000 milligram of dye per liter concentration to the sludge, and I let all the not so strong microbes to die, and whichever has survived that high dose of dye, I collected them, tried to isolate, tried to look at their DNA, and tried to work with only those that survived, and I call them the robust microbes. And then I tried to do this experiment with and without salt to prove that, okay, it is still possible for this microbe to degrade the dyes in the presence of salt. Yeah, that's how my study goes.
Right. So you're discovering like super microbes, basically.
Not really super, just normal.
Normal strong microbes.
Yeah. Normal strong microbes. Because I didn't find any new microbe. You know, these microbes already existed, and I happened to discover that, okay, these can do the job that I want. It's not like, you know, the particular species of microbe that wasn't reported earlier.
You are discovering new properties of these microbes,
yes.
Right? Yeah.
That's the discovery.
Mm-hmm. So you have this kind of, let's call it a super microbe. You have the super microbe that does really well in salt, but now you wanted to do something with the dyes, right? And they're also toxic on their own.
Yeah.
So how do you go about that?
Okay, that's the whole reason why I gave it a shock load, the sludge that I got from the reclamation plant. I gave it a shock load for a reason, so all the not so strong ones will die, and I can collect only those which can survive such toxic loads. So that's why I call it shock loading in my study. Yeah. Usually what people do in research is that they collect a source of microbes, like sludge is a source of microbes, okay? They have millions and millions inside. What they usually do is they top it up with maybe 100 milligram per liter of dye, and then try to see whichever is, and try to culture, try to acclimatize the microbes in that microbial source bit by bit. They try to acclimatize it bit by bit, but in my case, I didn't want it to do the conventional way. So that's the reason why I gave it a shock load.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I kind of want to take just one step back and wanted to ask you, how is this approach supposed to work? Like, how are the microbes supposed to get rid of the toxic dyes in the water?
Okay.
Like, how do they function?
Oh, okay. Yeah. How do they function? So, okay, the microbes, the like we eat food and get energy to do things in the same way. Researchers have done it in two different ways so far. Number one is the microbes eat the dyes. They consume the dye as food. So that's one way of doing it. And the other way of doing it is you give them glucose, a simple sugar, so that they can feed on it. And then there is also dyes inside the same culture. So what these microbes do is they feed on the glucose and other sources of food. And then the metabolites released during this process helps in the breakdown of the dye molecule. So the first one is called standalone pathway, and the second one is called co-metabolism. So I tried with both, then I realized that the microbes that I work, they can't do the standalone pathway. They require a carbon source, and only in the presence of carbon source can they degrade the dye.
Okay. So now you got this sludge sample, and then you are, what do you call it?
Like shock loading.
Shock loading, right. You shock load it, and then like most of the microbes are like gone. Yeah. They die.
Yeah, they died. They couldn't survive. Yeah.
And then you try both techniques on the remaining. But do you have to culture more microbes before? Or?
Okay, so this is where the microbiology part comes in, which I'm not well versed at all. Which I'm not well versed with at all. So thankfully there was a research fellow who tried to teach me some microbiological techniques before he left, but it happened in a very short time. Like he was only around for 6 months. In the first 6 months I could learn some techniques, but then I had to resort to YouTube to learn the remaining techniques that I require for my PhD. So what I did was, after all the microbes were, most microbes were dead after the shock loading, I tried to plate the microbes that are present in the remaining liquid, remaining sludge, bring the culture from liquid to solid, and then actually you can see different bacterial colonies, and then you run it 3 to 4 times to make sure that they are pure, and then that's how you make the stock solutions. Like they again transfer them into liquid and make the stock solutions and store them. So you could also do this by purchasing microbes from GenBanks, but rather I chose to get some microbes from a local source, wondering to see if I could find any new species of microbes, which I didn't, but at least I found that, okay, they still have the capability to degrade dyes. Yeah.
But you only need like a little bit of microbes and then, or a little bit of microbe itself, and then they can proliferate themselves, right?
Yeah.
So now you've done this, and you have these like microbes that work really well.
Yeah.
And then you have your two pathways as well. One of them is already dropped out.
Yes.
So how far do you take your co-metabolism pathway?
Okay. So besides all the things that I've mentioned, there are also other challenges that researchers have faced so far. So one being these textile dyes that that most people work with, they have a nitrogen bridge called azo bridge. And 70% of the dyes that are available in the market today have them. And of course, it is one of the reasons, this particular chemical bond is one of the reasons why the dyes are very stable. So in order to decolorize the wastewater, I must first break down that chemical bond. And then instantaneously, the wastewater becomes colorless. But the water is not clean enough to be disposed. It's not less toxic. It is even more toxic than the dye waste water in itself. It's more carcinogenic, and it's not at all safe to dispose it into any water streams, or rather it requires secondary wastewater treatment. So when you try to treat the textile wastewater, you break the molecule into two pieces or three pieces, and you think that, oh, this is colorless. Now I can dump it in the nearby wastewater stream. No, people have identified that though this is colorless, it contains something called aromatic amines. It's because the basic dye molecule is made up of carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, and sulfur. And carbon, especially in its aromatic form, like benzene or naphthalene, is with extra functional groups on it. It's not safe to be disposed, and it must be broken down a linear chain, like aliphatic compounds, which are safe enough to discard. So that is one of the major issues that researchers have faced. So you need to find out, after the decolorization is done, you need to find the fate of the compounds that are found in post-treatment. So my study involves trying to track the metabolites that are released during this process of degradation using liquid chromatography. Mm-hmm. And so another issue is that most researchers have only done this in no oxygen conditions. So that's when it's easier to break this N double bond N. That's what they have identified. But none of them have tried to actually do it in, like, more, only 10 to 15% of the papers, of the researchers that I, of the papers of the researchers that I've read so far have done it in aerobic conditions. But those are all, so that's how I chose to do all these experiments in the presence of oxygen. So
what's the difference there?
So, okay, most researchers, like 70 to 80% of them, they have done these experiments in no oxygen conditions. I call it anaerobic, okay? Mm. So researchers have found this N double bond N is easy to break to make the dye colorless. It's easy to break in no oxygen condition. And there is a small set of researchers that have proved that it is still possible in the presence of oxygen, which is called aerobic conditions. Okay. So when you try to deploy research at the industrial scale, it's hard to maintain anaerobic conditions. Okay. It's hard to maintain anaerobic conditions. And like all the treatment, wastewater treatment plants that exist today, they all use advanced oxidation processes and things like that, which involves oxygen. Okay. Mm-hmm. So I thought it would be easy to translate my research into the real life
application.
Into real life application if I perform this in aerobic conditions. So what I did is I chose those microbes based on this as one of the parameters as well. So one is to make sure that these microbes work in salt conditions in the presence of oxygen, and also to ensure that these microbes also eat or try to degrade the bigger chunks of the broken dye molecules into smaller chunks, so it is safe to either, so the wastewater generated at the end doesn't require a secondary treatment.
So this is very heavily like function driven. Like, you guys are really focusing on whether this can actually work in the industry.
Yeah.
And not just in your kind of lab setting.
Yeah.
It's very interesting. So just a little bit more about your research. When you follow the co-metabolic pathway, mm-hmm. right? You said the actual microbe is eating a secondary thing that you put in, like glucose, right? It's not directly eating your dye.
Yeah, actually, glucose is the primary carbon source, and dye is the secondary carbon source. Yeah, okay. Because it can't eat the dye alone, based on the experiment. So glucose then becomes the primary source. And then, yeah.
It's like a main dish.
It's like it's like saving the good things or bad things for the last.
Okay.
Right, right. So it eats the glucose,
yeah,
and it generates other compounds.
Yeah, enzymes.
Enzymes.
Yeah, okay. Enzymes that can actually... So when you put in the dye, so there is a kind of enzymes that are produced as a response to the stress. So these microbes, they want to survive. Okay, they are like fighting back with the dye. So they are producing some enzymes that can break down these N double bond N or the aromatic structures into aliphatic structures. I mean the linear chained carbon. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That makes sense. Oh, well, they fight back.
Yeah, they fight back. That's called stress response. I think everybody does it, not just microbes.
That's true.
Yeah. Wow. So.
And so how effective was this approach, like, in terms of, I don't know, what's the...
benchmark?
Quantitative. Yeah, what's the benchmark metric you use?
Okay. So let's go back to the dye bath again. So this dye bath after the dyeing, so it contains about not more than 100 ppm of dye, 100 milligram per liter of dye in the spent dye bath.
Mm-hmm.
So that is about 0.1 gram in 1 liter. So the main concern for any treatment, any wastewater, is that the number one concern would be color. And dyes at even such small concentrations are still colored. The water is colored. Like, let's say there is a yellow color dye. People would automatically, their mind would go to, oh, this looks like urine, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So people associate things with different things with the colors. So you have to make sure that the color is removed, and at the same time, it's also good to... reuse or whatever your end goal is. So like I mentioned, there is 0.1 gram per liter of dye that at most 0.1 gram per liter of the dye that is left in the spent dye bath. So this is how I've decided at what concentration I want my microbes to work at. Okay. So that's how I chose 100 milligram per liter or 0.1 gram per liter as the maximum concentration that I'll give the microbes to degrade it into smaller molecules. Okay, so why it has to be not more than 0.1 gram per liter is that the textile dyeing industry would lose a lot of dye if there is more dye remaining in the spent dye. So it can't be more than that. So these are the two reasons why I worked with that concentrations throughout my experiments after the isolation has been done, post the shock loading. So I have worked with three different dyes that are available in the market. Like, most used colors are blue for the jeans, of course. And then I worked with orange and red. So these three are, though they're all azo dyes, because there is an N double bond N in all the three dyes, they are called, classified as azo dyes. They are all chemically different. One of the dye would have just one azo bond, and the other dyes may have more azo bonds, and that's what defines their complexity. So I worked with three different dyes to compare and see which one is the hardest to decolorize or degrade, and then see why things are happening in a certain way, why there is a particular pattern, decolorization rate is faster or slower, and why, based on the kinetics and the chemistry or the complexity of the molecule. That's how I quantified my work, like how long would it take, how many days would it take for this dye concentration to go from 100 milligram per liter to 10 milligram per liter or lower. So that's how I quantified.
I see. So not only do they reduce the concentration, they also have to do it in a pretty quick amount of time.
Yeah. It took like 3 to 5 days for different types of dyes that I worked with. Yeah. But it didn't necessarily follow the rules, the chemistry rules that I've mentioned earlier. Like, a dye would have two azo bridges, and then it would be degraded faster than a dye with just one azo bond. technically it is supposed to be okay, one is easier and two is hard, so this must be faster than that. No, it didn't happen in the particular way that I expected it to be, which makes my study interesting. So then I have to work hard and try to understand what is the reason for the microbe to behave in that particular way. Yeah.
Did you find out?
Yeah, it's not just the number of azo bridges, but also depends on the how crowded the molecule is. Like these aromatic structures, they have some functional groups attached to them. And if there are too many functional groups blocking the azo bridge or trying to cloud the azo bridge, so it makes it hard for the electron to reach there and break the bridge. So it's unsaturated, right? N double bond is unsaturated. That's why it has, they're sharing the electron. And when the microbe is trying to make enzymes that can act as electron donor, this clouding effect is not letting the electron donor to reach there. So yeah, things like that do affect the degradation rate kind of thing.
That's really interesting. Wow. So you mentioned the time scale that you figured out for these microbes to function was 3 to 5 days. How does that compare with like that Jurong plant?
Okay, so technically my work is not possible to be translated into the practical applications. It can, because usually nobody has that kind of amount of time or money or space to do such kind of, you know, waiting for 5 days for the treatment to happen, because usually longer times to treat a waste would be longer, would be technically termed as longer hydraulic retention time. So longer time to treat is called longer hydraulic retention time, which translates to huge reactors in the treatment plant. Mm. And for a country like Singapore, where land is expensive and limited, you can't do it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So what I would say is maybe we can complement this with physicochemical treatment techniques, like using biochar for adsorption of the dyes, and then also add in microbes so that these adsorbed dyes are eaten by the microbes. So we could do things like that, or urine techniques, membrane bioreactors, which have both membranes like a filter and also the microbes, which can do both the job at the same time and much quicker. Yeah.
So this could be like a complementary or supplementary technique.
Yeah. So each technique has its own pros and cons. Like mine, though it is economical and sustainable, it takes a longer time. So other techniques could be more expensive to treat this wastewater as a whole, but with the help of microbes, maybe the treatment cost is cut down to half or less. So when we try to combine them both, you need less space, less money, but treatment is not. Yeah, usually that's how things are in industry.
Right. Is there a way like to kind of work with the dye manufacturers, mm-hmm. and collaborate into coming up with, you know, chemically stable dyes that are also easy to break down in a, like, with some certain, you know, mm-hmm. techniques? Do you think that's a possible future for this?
That is certainly possible. I think we have a new research center that got opened in MSC recently. It's called Sustec, which is Sustainable Textiles. Yeah, I think they're trying to do something in collaboration with industries. From my current PI is involved as one of the supervisors there as well, so that I came to know about it. And one more thing that I found interesting, I don't know if other countries are doing this or not, but places like H&M and Uniqlo these days, they accept a lot of used clothes. And then I don't know if Uniqlo is giving out vouchers, but H&M used to give vouchers for almost 4 years. Been doing it, give my waste clothes and I get a voucher. But previously it used to be like the voucher must be used within a month, but now they're giving vouchers that are valid for 2 years. I think now their mindset is also now directed towards, you know, making people rethink their decisions, like using clothes, the same clothes more often rather than just use and throw kind of way.
Right.
I think they're trying to imbibe that in the society. I'm not sure if that is the main motto behind giving vouchers that are valid for 2 years. Yeah, that's something that I found interesting.
That is certainly interesting. So, because they,
I had no idea they do that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting.
They do want to cut down, but the it's very interesting that they moved away from like 1 month to like 2 years.
That's
quite drastic.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Are there any things like we have not asked you about regarding, you know, the textile, dyes, water, waste, and all that?
You can pick a few things that you think would be like really interesting for anyone listening that happens to be like getting into your field.
I have done one more thing, that like two more things that I didn't mention here, is that I worked with instruments like for identifying the fragments of the dye after degradation, right? So I used a very fancy instrument that people usually use for forensic for to achieve greater accuracy and precision. So what I try to do is I try to match this. So it's more like chemistry and technical. I don't know if you want to listen to it.
For sure, yeah.
If you think someone would benefit from it, yeah.
Okay, so how I went about identifying the fragments, both known and unknown, from the after the breakdown of the dye molecules, that I use this instrument called liquid double MS. S stands for mass spectrometry. So what I essentially try to do is I give in the liquid samples, then there is a column that separates, there is a packed column that separates all the molecules or the dye fragments inside the sample based on their polarity. And so what I did was, there is this molecules in the sample, so they go through the column, and then the column there is another organic liquid that tries to push these metabolites out into the machine one by one. So the packed column separates these molecules based on their polarity or charge, overall charge, and then there is another liquid called mobile phase that pushes it out of the column, and then there is a detector to detect it one by one. So the detector, so it's quite accurate with 4 digits accuracy after the dot. Okay, so which is like super accurate. So once these first time I send them in, and then I try to identify the mass to charge ratio. So that's how the mass to charge ratio, that's how they are separated. And then once I identify these molecules, I don't know what they are, they could be anything. I try to bombard them again with some energy, with different energies, 0 to 40 electrovolt. And then this one molecule will be broken down into different more fragments. And then based on these fragments, mass to charge ratio again of these fragments, I try to compare it with the database, like HMDB or Metlin scripts, which are all available online and free to use for public. So you just try to feed this data into these databases online and try to compare it with the existing molecules. Then you can zero down to which molecule it could be.
Right.
Yeah. So that's like a guesswork, educated guesswork based on the instrument and also the existing. And of course, I didn't find some things that are nowhere present in the database, and I don't know what they are as well.
Right.
So that would be a research, whole different research on its own.
Right.
Yeah.
So, but how did you, how were you introduced to this machine?
This machine. Yeah. So
what's it called again?
Liquid chromatography.
Okay.
Mass spectrometry. It's called LCMS.
So it classifies based on mass and charge, basically. Charge to mass.
Mass to charge ratio.
Mass to charge ratio.
Yeah. So I was introduced to this machine by my prof himself, because he does a lot of this kind of analysis for different kinds of persistent organic pollutants emerging these days, especially in the past 1 to 2 decades. There is a lot of, and that is also one of the reasons why I chose textiles to waters, because they are also persistent organs. If you see persistent, very difficult to degrade, that's why they're called persistent. And organic, because they have the base molecule for is carbon, hydrogen, and sulfur. So anything that contains all these all these atoms are considered organic.
Right.
And then, of course, they're pollutants. They're polluting the environment. So that's why. So he has been doing a lot of work on LC-MS, MS. And I was introduced to this. And I would say it took me almost 1 year to crack that. What's exactly happening?
Right.
Like how to use the right from how to use the instrument to how to what kind of analysis, targeted analysis or untargeted analysis I need to do, and what do I do with the data, and how do I use this data for my work?
That's exactly what I was going to ask. So, what do you do with the data? Because some molecules maybe you don't find them in the database.
Yeah.
Okay, so leave them alone. Yeah. What do you do with the rest, the ones that you identify?
Okay, so the ones that I identified are also mostly not available in the database, because this kind of work for textile wastewater isn't done before. This kind of trying to find the fate of what happens to a molecule or a pollutant has been done in other fields, but not for textile waste. So I couldn't find matches for most of the molecules, but rather what I did is I worked with three different dyes, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I tried to look at research papers where people worked with these dyes, and they have, and most of the time they haven't done the fate of the dye analysis, how their dyes are transformed. So what I did was I tried to, I had a pile of research papers where the transformation of dyes, that kind of work is done using this particular instrument. And I would try to compare the structures of the dyes that they have worked with already and try to see how similar or different my dyes are with them. And then if I try to find something similar, and I'll try to match and see, okay, this dye, this particular dye that was worked by particular researcher A has shown these products A, B, C. And I look at mine and see, okay, maybe this section of this particular dye is comparable to my dye. Okay, so there is possibility that I can get the fragment A. Then I'll try to compare. So that's how it's like more like an educated guesswork.
Mm.
Yeah, that's how I did it.
So you try and match your fragments to their fragments, other papers.
Yeah, other papers. Not technically the same dyes, but
And at some point you mentioned that after the breakdown of the dye, the water can still be
toxic.
So how do you deal with that? So if it's still toxic, do you do more extra work, or is just classified as toxic and then you move to the next dye?
No. So that's what all the researchers have done so far. They just say, oh, okay, this is more carcinogenic and toxic as compared to the dye wastewater in itself. So rather what I did is I rather tried to wait longer. That's why I had longer retention times, like 3 to 5 days. So previously people would just do their work in 24 to 48 hours, and then they say, oh, this dye got decolorized up to 100% within 24 hours. Even I managed to do that. It's not that it didn't happen in my case, despite it being in the presence of oxygen, which is even another barrier for the microbes to cross. What I rather did is I waited for longer time so that these organic molecules, bigger chunk of molecules, are also broken into smaller fragments. So it's less toxic as compared to...
So this whole LC-MS was to determine exactly how toxic it is right at the end.
Not exactly how toxic. It's to find out what exactly is this molecule, is the molecule. Yeah.
I see.
Yeah. So once the degradation, once the treated wastewater becomes colorless, and you know that there is still something remaining inside with the help of a total organic carbon analyzer. So I put this sample in a TOC analyzer. I still see that there is up to 70 to 80% of organic carbon still remain in the liquid. That means the dye has not transformed into smaller molecules yet. So that's after checking that, I come to LC-MS and try to see what is happening at day 1, day 2, or day 1.5, day 2.5. Like I have certain time points where I try to see what happens at what time point, and then try to understand, okay, at this time point, this particular molecule is transformed to from fragment A to fragment B. And then after 3 days, this fragment B becomes fragment C. So that's how I draw a transformation pathway for dyes. So I start with the dye, then I try to tell you which fragments happens at what time point.
So if there was like a toxicity kind of, not a benchmark, but like a threshold, toxicity threshold, could you, for example, stop at day four and say, well, at day four, everything is at least fragment, let's say D. So whatever is left that hasn't transformed to, let's say, fragment E is fine.
Yeah, I was able to tell that I did some toxicity experiments using mung beans where the mung beans won't sprout if the wastewater is too toxic. So with whatever wastewater samples I had, I used them to grow mung beans in them, but few of them didn't show sprouts and few of them did, which means the ones with sprouts are considered okay, this is not toxic, and the ones that didn't is toxic. Okay, so even though it is toxic sometimes, because if you are going to reuse the same water within the same industry, sometimes it is possible to use it, though it is toxic, because you're not going to discard the streams. So with a little bit of toxicants inside and some organic compounds inside, you can still recycle for a few cycles.
Right. And then you can tell exactly where you are along that path. Right. So what other instrument did you use?
What other instrument did I use? This is the only fancy instrument that I've used. I failed like more than 100 times in trying to crack that exact formula. Finding which kind of mobile phases I need, or what kind of column, or which mode I have to operate the instrument in, positive or negative or both.
You said it took you like a whole year
To figure it out, And then another half a year to understand and become an expert at how to analyze the data and compare it with the databases.
I mean, a lot of the time, I think this is what the PhD is all about. It's about learning these like different skills, whether it's an instrument or maybe it's like, I don't know, like troubleshooting certain, like the skill of troubleshooting certain problems and all that. I just had one last question, like, regarding this. Is there a way like to separate the dye instead of breaking it down, like separate it from water?
There is certainly ways, like filtration, infiltration.
That's what the filtration does. Okay.
Yeah, and also, you know, carbon activated carbon or biochar. So you can put that and all the color gets absorbed onto the carbon, and then what you get is a solution. But the disadvantage of using these physicochemical techniques is that you need to, there is a lot of sludge produced, or there is, when this the dye gets absorbed onto it, this again needs to be treated if you have to discard it in somewhere.
Correct.
It again needs to be discarded. You're going round and round about the same issue. So instead, what you could do is you could degrade it.
Yeah, that seems like the way to go.
Or we could also work with a material scientist who can prepare, like you mentioning earlier, right, dyes that are made from natural maybe like fruits or flowers, but make sure they add some additives or mixtures to make sure that they are stable enough, a few washes,
right?
Yeah, they could do things like that.
Or dyes with like a self-destruct, you know, so you put them in, that's what you were talking about, right? You put them in a certain microbe or a certain environment, and they just let go.
That's possible.
Maybe, but I think those natural source dyes are more expensive. Is that?
No, they don't last long enough.
Oh, that's their issue.
Because there are some dyes, like after first few washes, the color is completely faded, and you don't want to wear them, right?
No. I don't think anyone.
That's the major issue with the natural dyes.
Okay. Each episode, we do the same thing where, like, we try to get to know our guests a bit more.
Oh, yeah.
Get to know about their, you know, interests outside of the lab. We rarely have guests who have completed their PhD. So maybe you can tell us a little bit more about that as well. Like, how did it go for you after you defended your thesis?
So whoever does PhD, I know it takes a lot of time, 4 to 5 years of your life, and oftentimes you can't expect the life to be the same after. And during the journey also, one might face a lot of personal issues and family. One must have some other avenues out to keep sane. Like I personally used to participate in public speaking. I used to review on, I was in my Google headers for my girl.
Wow, that's interesting. Maps,
yeah. And then I proudly represented Singapore, by the way, then back in 19. And then for public speaking, I joined the call Toast International.
Right.
I was attached to this post-grads club at N. It's called Nagas. I was there first. I finished a few levels in terms of public speaking. You know, you have a number of speeches on different topics and you keep leveling up in the...
Were they technical topics or general?
No, just general. So what they try to teach... So in that environment, they try to nurture in you is that... No, they try to bring out the public speaker in you. Like, sometimes you might have to give a speech that, you know, that inspires the audience. Or sometimes you have to... give them a lot of information about a topic, a particular topic,
right.
Things like that. Yeah.
Interesting.
So I did those both. And then in the last 2 years, I wasn't involved in any of these things because I wanted the time. And of course, COVID didn't allow us to do anything other than that. So I was completely focused on work and writing. I believe I did a good job, if not great.
All right.
I mean, it worked, right?
Yeah, finally I graduated. That's what matters.
Okay. And what are you doing right now?
So right now I'm a research fellow at School of Marine Science Engineering. Uh-huh. And Prof. Dalton Day is my supervisor, trying to recycle battery waste from electric vehicles, phones, laptops. And we are trying to use food waste to treat the battery waste.
Oh,
yeah.
Interesting.
And we have a pilot plant in the industrial area in Jurong. There is a 1,000-liter reactor that I'll be operating. So once things are fine with the pilot plant, we will then have maybe a commercial scale reactor in Singapore. We already have our industry partner with us. We hope things will also translate from pilot plant to the commercial scale.
Yeah, all the best of luck.
Oh, thank you.
Maybe
thank
you can come back and tell us about it as well.
Sure.
I was curious, right at the start, you mentioned that you had two supervisors.
Yeah.
How does that work? Like, and I'm guessing both of them are very senior, right?
Yes. Both are seniors, like almost at the peak of their careers. Yeah. Okay, so there is this, you all know that there is thesis advisory committee, right?
Mm-hmm.
You have to meet them every twice a year. Yeah, you have to meet them twice a year, and occasionally, so most of the time I would meet my main supervisor because I'm more attached to CEE, and basically I majored in that. So I used to meet him quite regularly, and he used to give me suggestions. Because he's also worked with Micros before, he would easily understand what I was doing. Besides the help from whatever help I got from Prof. William Shen, he himself... My main prof also, he himself knew some things about microbes. So both of them used to guide me during those thesis advisory committees, but rest of the time it used to be my main support. But given that they have good rapport amongst themselves, like with the mentor, Soup and Gosu, so it used to be a very smooth ride during the advisory committees.
So you would have one main supervisor to go to for any immediate concerns?
Yeah, like all the lab fundings or consumables or instrument usage or any kind of signatures, I would always go main supervisor. So he has more responsibilities, like let's say 60-40%. Mm-hmm. Yeah, 60% is on the supervisor.
So that's admin. So what about at the start, you were doing lit review, right?
Yeah.
Right at the start.
Yeah.
So you were probably guiding your kind of, or solidifying your direction,
yeah,
right? Mm-hmm. So... do both of them have input into your direction, or is it your main supervisor mainly guiding your path?
Oh, it's always been both of them, because at the end of the day, both of them should be satisfied with the kind of work that I do and produce, the data that I produce. So it's been right from the beginning, they are always involved in all the thesis advice meetings and they would give their input and I try to use it to produce data for based on that and present it in the next TAC.
I see.
Yeah. Huh. Yeah. But I have started my lit review way before, 6 months before I came to Singapore. So I've been talking in talks with my main supervisor since December 2015. Then I arrived in Singapore July 2016. So I kind of read a few papers and then we conversations back and forth with my main soup. Then when I arrived here, he kind of he gave me an overview on how my PhD journey is going to be. And then he tried to guide me through, like, I came up with a topic. And then he said that he has already translated that kind of research into practical applications already. And then he's not interested in that kind of work anymore and wanted me to look at different kind of pollutants. Like, and I really value and respect his judgment a lot because now you see there is a new research institute at MSC looking at textile waste, right? Yeah, so this guy has my professor has a vision for future telling and asked me to do, okay, persistent organic pollutants, these are the future, go for it. And I'm glad I listened to his words.
That's really valuable. Awesome. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you rarely meet such
people, I guess.
Yeah. Very genuine advice on the progression of your field.
Yes, yes. And he's also this person who actually imbibed this how to make a carry out a quality research. So he's always been this person who says it's not about how much you know, it's about how you use whatever little you know.
Mm.
So that has always been my inspiration. Like if you go in NTU, Dr. NTU and see my thesis, I'm not proud of it. My thesis is only about 120 pages, including the references. But throughout these 4 to 5 years that I worked, I have learned a lot about PhD, how to carry out a quality research about life, how to be peaceful, how to handle stress and... You know, things like that. It's not just work all the time.
Right.
Yeah, he helped me big time.
That's good to hear. Yeah, I mean, we should all learn, like, from our PhD journeys, like, about persistence and, you know, like, never giving up, right?
Yeah, dedication and perseverance.
Right. Mm. Yeah, that's, great to hear.
Yeah, seems like your journey was fruitful. Would you say so?
My journey was what?
Fruitful.
It definitely, you reap all that you sow, that I would say. But during the times, during the journey itself, as my personal life has been quite bumpy. But luckily, my supervisor, once again, he stepped in and me a lot. If not, it would not have been possible for me to finish my journey.
Wow.
He literally held my hand and made me cross that finish line.
Yeah, that's
incredible. Yeah.
He's an incredible human being, trust me.
It's a shame he's retired now.
Yeah, but he has his own businesses, so...
Oh, fair enough.
Yeah.
He wants to concentrate on them.
Okay, good for him.
Yeah.
All right, I guess with that, Dr. Gopi, thank you very much for coming to our podcast.
Oh, thank you very much, Ahmad Malik, for inviting me over the podcast. I hope I did justification to your podcast. Of course, thanks to Christopher for introducing me to this.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.